Welcome, everyone. It's Peter Fullerton, the branch manager with the Harbor Group, and we've got Robin Gullison, who's going to give us an overview, as he has over the past months, lots of change continues in the marketplace, and I think you'll find it very interesting. Further, we had the 2015 federal budget yesterday. We are going to put together a piece and email it out to clients. It will be on our website later today, and we will have a conference call early next week going over the pertinent parts of that budget. So keep an eye out for that, or go to our website, and you can download the piece that's already there. Robin, over to you.
Great. Thanks a lot, Peter, and thank you very much for joining us, everybody. So I'm going to go through a quick overview of our strategy for the second quarter of 2015, after which Chris Newell, one of the partners at the Harbor Group, is going to ask me a few questions we think are on the minds of clients. So I'll just get right into it. You know, one of the big themes we're seeing this year, I'd say the biggest theme 2015 year to date, has been that central banks globally have been kind of dominating the news flow in financial markets. And one could argue this has been the case since the financial crisis. They've been deeply involved. But if you think about what's happened year to date this year, we've had the European Central Bank engage in quantitative easing, also known as printing money to buy bonds. This is after the U.S. Federal Reserve and the Bank of Japan have already engaged in this, so they kind of dragged their feet. They're finally doing it. Here, closer to home, we had the Bank of Canada with a surprise rate cut in January. And then, of course, lastly, the debate continues to rage about when the U.S. Federal Reserve is eventually going to raise interest rates for the first time. The consensus has moved from June of this year to some point later, September, maybe later. The bigger point to us is this going to happen, yes or no? And when it does, we think there's implications for the markets that we'll get to in a little bit. So again, looking back to the central banks and how they impacted the first quarter, the European Central Bank engaging in quantitative easing was quite a big deal. It resulted in significant weakness in the euro currency and a significant outperformance of European equities. And this is something we think is likely to continue, as the European equity market has been relatively well valued compared to other markets around the world. And again, the European Central Bank, after waiting a very long time to do this, has finally stepped in. And the results have been quite extraordinary throughout all markets. If you look at German government bonds, we think our government bond yields are low, with 10-year bonds at about 1.5% in Canada, 2% in the U.S. German 10-year bonds yield 0.15%. And the German yield curve, so yields for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9-year bonds, are all negative, so negative out to about 8 or 9 years. So if you buy a German 2-year bond, you're going to get back less money than you put into it when it matures, which is quite extraordinary. And that's a very powerful effect on how people invest. And it pushes them further out the risk curve. So people who previously would have owned government bonds have probably said, well, I can't live with a negative yield, so I'm going to buy a corporate bond. And when the yield on a high-grade corporate bond gets too low, they go to high-yield bonds, and eventually they go to the equity market. And that's why you typically see equity markets perform very well when you have the central banks printing money, performing quantitative easing, because they suppress the rate of return on all the safe assets. Therefore, people are forced to go into the riskier ones. And that's what we've seen in Europe, and we saw it in Japan, we saw it in the U.S., and it's been a very powerful force year-to-date in Europe. So turning quickly to the U.S., and what seems to become almost an annual rite of passage, the U.S. economy suffered a soft patch in the first quarter. There's a lot of things you can blame here. You had kind of rough winter weather on the eastern part of the country. You happen to have great weather on the western part of the country, but the western United States was also affected by a large strike at the ports in California, which affected a lot of trade flow. So we think there's a reasonable chance that this data in the first quarter has been affected by that, and we're willing to give it the benefit of the doubt until the data coming in proves differently. So we think it's a soft patch and just that. We don't think it's anything more nefarious. A lot of the indicators we watch for a recession, which is what we're really looking for in the economy, are we going to have a recession, yes or no? Because over the long term, that's been the large predictor of bear markets. And when we look at things like, do we have tight money, yes or no? Well, not at all. We have the U.S. still with rates around zero, thinking about maybe raising them later this year. And you've got long-term rates higher than short-term rates. You don't have what they call an inverted yield curve. You have employment continuing to grow. You've got housing continuing to turn the corner. Industrial production, manufacturing doing well. So all those sort of things aren't pointing to a recession right now, and that's kind of what we look for out of the U.S. economy, and we don't see that right now. We also wanted to highlight a couple of indicators that maybe don't get as much traction in mainstream media, but we think are pretty interesting. One of the things we're looking at is the number of job openings in the U.S., so how many jobs are going unfilled. And that's actually near a record high. And that's kind of a different way of looking at labor market strength. If you have a lot of jobs that are open and going unfilled, well, that means that there is a strong demand for labor that's not necessarily being met. So we think that bodes well for jobs growth going forward. We also look at household formations. This is simply the number of people that are forming a household, so moving out of their parents' house and either renting an apartment or buying a home. And I think this is a pretty powerful statement, because you think about all the sentiment surveys and such you hear people say, oh, the consumer sentiment's at a five-year high or whatever it might be. Well, it's one thing to ask somebody how they feel about the economy. It's quite another thing to do something significantly as forming a household, going out and buying a home or renting one, taking on all that expense and risk. That's a much more powerful statement to me than somebody answering a survey. So we think these increase in household formations is a bullish sign for the economy and should also bode well for the U.S. housing market. Turning to Canada, this country is learning to live without $100 oil, and it's been felt in the currency markets in particular, as everybody on the call I'm sure knows. We think the Canadian dollar is now trading close to fair value when you look at something like purchasing power parity. So that is a theory that suggests that regardless of the currency used, you should be able to buy the same amount of goods in Canada or the U.S. once you adjust for the exchange rate. And I think most people would agree that's fairly balanced now. I think if you think about when the Canadian dollar is really strong, you saw a lot of things like massive cross-border shopping by Canadians, people buying second homes in Florida at a very attractive price, that sort of thing. And when the Canadian dollar gets really, really weak, you'll probably see the opposite. You'll see a lot more Americans buying cottages here in Canada, taking vacations, et cetera. And then now I think it's somewhat balanced. It's, cross-border shopping is not as attractive as it once was, but I don't think we're seeing a huge influx of American money quite yet either. So the Canadian dollar has traditionally been driven by two major things, the level of interest rates in Canada compared to the U.S., and commodity prices. And for the longest time in the last 5 years, it's been mostly about interest rates, because oil traded in a range of about $80 to $100 a barrel, and nobody really gave it a second thought. That's just kind of where oil was, and it wasn't a big factor in the currency. Now you've got interest rates that are intertwined with the currency, because the Bank of Canada cut interest rates in January because of the weakness in oil and the related effect on the economy. So I think for the next little while here, you're going to see oil and interest rates in Canada be fairly tightly correlated, and that means the Canadian dollar becomes a much bigger trade on oil, because both of the factors affecting the Canadian dollar are going to be linked. So the lower Canadian dollar definitely helps cushion the blow from the drop in oil, but it doesn't eliminate it. If we look at economic growth forecasts for Canada this year, RBC actually has Ontario outperforming the rest of the country. I think it's pretty interesting when you look at all these provincial budgets that are rolling out now. As Peter Folger mentioned, we had the Canadian budget yesterday. We're getting the Ontario one, I believe, in 2 days. And we've already had Alberta and Quebec. I think it's pretty interesting that you have Alberta running a record deficit, increasing taxes and user fees, while you have Quebec with a balanced budget and talking about eventually cutting taxes. I mean, a year ago, who would have thought that was anywhere near possible? So barring higher oil prices, RBC continues to see the path of least resistance for the Canadian dollar to be lower. They forecast the loonie to hit about 75 cents by mid-year, bottoming about 74.5 cents at the end of the third quarter. After that, they see a slow grind higher to around 77.5 cents by the end of 2016, which is still lower than we are today. So if oil snaps back quite strongly, I'd expect those forecasts to be revised higher for the Canadian dollar. But if we stay where we are and the Bank of Canada doesn't move on interest rates while the U.S. starts to move, then I'd expect more weakness in the Canadian dollar if that were to come to pass. Another theme we're looking at going forward is how to prepare portfolios for eventually higher interest rates. We've talked about this for years. It seems every year the drill is the same, right? The banks are all surveyed on where they think interest rates are going to go. Every year the forecast is higher. And every year for the last 5 years, except 2013, that's been wrong. Interest rates have surprised at a downside quite a bit in most years since the financial crisis. But eventually we'll get to a point where we think they will start going higher. The U.S. starting to raise rates later on this year could be a catalyst for that. So while we're not necessarily taking action right now, we're trying to figure out what are the best ways to protect portfolios if this happens. And we look at dividend growth versus dividend yield stocks, because that's the majority of most of our portfolios, either stocks with a high yield providing high income to people, or stocks that pay a dividend but it's got a lower yield and it grows. And those should react very differently when we see higher rates. Because if you think about a stock with a yield of, say, 5%, and that yield doesn't change, so the company is not growing the dividend. If you have interest rates go up by, say, 1%, so that yield on that stock goes from 5% to 6%, yield on long-term bonds go from 2% to 3%, the price deterioration on a stock like that would actually be similar to that of a long-term bond. Whereas we think stocks that are able to grow their dividend should withstand that better. A really good example would be looking at the performance of dividend yield versus dividend growth over the last, since 2009. So from 2009 to 2011, you saw interest rates broadly going lower, and in 2012, you saw the U.S. 10-year yield put in its generational low. And during that time, stocks with high yields, so like REITs and telcos, massively outperformed sectors that have strong dividend growth, like consumer staples and industrials. But since rates in the U.S. have bottomed, even though they're still very low, you've seen a switch to dividend growth outperforming. So the consumer staples and the industrials have significantly outperformed things like the REITs and the telecoms since that time's happened. And again, the yield on those sectors of dividend growth is much lower. It's in the ones compared to the fours to fives for the REITs and the telcos. But the market has finally started to value growth over yield, and that's a big shift that we from what we've seen in the last few years. So we think if interest rates start to go higher, that's the trend that likely continues. And of course, every investor has their own portfolio needs. Some people require higher income, and that's fine. We don't expect companies to start cutting their dividends because of higher rates, but we just have to understand that high dividend yield with no growth may be a challenge on the capital side compared to something that is growing its dividend. And it's something to discuss with your advisor, what kind of mix is appropriate for you. So what else works when interest rates rise? Well, there's rate-sensitive business models out there, so things like the insurance companies are fairly sensitive to higher long-term interest rates. Those tend to be a go-to in the market when you see rates going higher. So those are some things we're looking at in portfolios. Of course, we're already there with some of those positions. Commodity exposure tends to do well. Now, that's something that is absolutely hated right now. Most people are underweight commodities. We have been for a long time, so if commodities start to turn, I think that'll be a surprise for a lot of people. So something we're watching, not taking action on right now. I mentioned strong dividend growth, and certain types of preferred shares also have leverage to higher interest rates, which we'll get to in a little bit. So looking more broadly at the market, we think equities are fairly valued in the context of depressed energy earnings, low inflation, and low interest rates. So if you look at the earnings expectations for all the different sectors in the market, most of them are kind of flat to higher year to date, except for the energy sector, of course. Energy earnings have been absolutely decimated, and that's affected the P-E ratio of the entire market because the E, the earnings for the entire market, has gone down slightly. Expectation has gone down because of energy, and that raises the P-E ratio. So we think we're kind of at a fair valuation for the equity market, considering we have low interest rates, low inflation, and what I think is higher quality economic growth. So if you look back to the previous cycle, 2004 to 2008, you had an unsustainable housing boom in the U.S. with people using their homes as an ATM, and you had this commodity boom in Canada due to what was going on in China, which was sort of one-time in nature. We all know how those ended. And today you've got slow but steady growth, low inflation. You don't have a housing boom going on in the United States. You have one in Canada, but I don't think it has quite the same effect on the overall economy as the U.S. one did. And you've got commodities in a bear market. So I think a lot of those excesses that were there last time around aren't really there. So we think the quality of economic growth is better, and therefore to have the market valued at a similar level as it was back then seems fairly reasonable to us. Looking at the TSX in particular, again, it's no surprise the TSX has a very strong correlation with oil this year, and it's actually the whole market that has had a strong correlation because energy is a big weight and financials are a big weight. So if you go back to earlier this year, people kind of broke the Canadian market into three chunks. You had commodities, which were toxic to people. You had banks, which people didn't want to own because they're afraid that their earnings growth is going to be slowing down and that they had exposure to energy, and yet everything else. And people really paid up for the everything else at the end of the year. And some of those stocks have done well because of the strong fund flows, but the valuations are a little more challenging. And lo and behold, the banks that were left for dead are now sitting near their year-to-date highs. And the energy stocks have done better than the market as well. So I think just that's another way to show that we always have to be diversified, and we never want to make a binary bet that one thing is going to happen over another. So we're very unlikely to go zero-weight energy or zero-weight in banks or 100% in anything else because we don't think it makes sense to make 100% bets. Investing is a game of probabilities. You weigh those probabilities with the way you think things are going to work out, and you make your choices. But to go zero-weight in a major sector in Canada is not something we think we're really going to do. So longer term, we think this binary nature of the market will fade. So we think longer term, you know, once oil starts to normalize or even just starts to be less volatile and find a new trading level, the market should trade on its own merits, and we'll see, you know, people trade companies on their earnings and what their outlooks look like as opposed to just trading on these big macroeconomic themes like the energy market. So that's all I have for my prepared comments, but Chris Newell, I believe, has a couple of questions for me.
Terrific. Thanks very much, Robin. That was very detailed. So if you were to wrap that up in a very summary call for a layperson, would you say that this is a good time to be at their market exposure, overweight or underweight equities?
I think depending on somebody's risk tolerance, we wouldn't want to be underweight here because we see very low total return prospects in government bonds. With yields where they are and with the sensitivity to interest rates being what they are, we think it's very unlikely that investors are going to earn much more than their coupon over the medium term, so let's call that five-ish years, because to earn the historical returns people have earned on bonds, you'd have to see interest rates continue to drop, and even though we are seeing some small negative interest rates in Europe, that's something that's unlikely to go on for a long period of time, and you'd have to go deeply negative in Canada over a five-year period to generate the historical total returns. So people are always going to own government bonds and cash as the safety part of their portfolio. Again, we wouldn't suggest going to zero in anything, but we think the superior total return prospects are going to be in equities. So I'd say for most people, they should be, most people are probably market weight or higher in their equity exposure.
Okay. So within the fixed income component, which you've suggested investors be underweight relative to their benchmark in, perhaps we could turn the sights on one specific component, and that's preferred shares. Preferred shares have been under all sorts of volatility over the course of the last 6 months, especially in the last 3 months. Could you give us a little background on the preferred share market?
Certainly. So what Chris is referring to is the rate reset preferred shares. And the reason these came into being was if you go back to the early 2000s, all the preferred shares being issued were either retractable preferred shares or perpetual preferred shares. So retractable preferred shares are sort of like a bond. You have a date where you can get your money back. But the rules changed for the banks, and the banks weren't allowed to issue retractable preferred shares and have them count towards their capital base anymore. Therefore, they issued perpetual preferred shares. Those are preferred shares with a fixed coupon that goes on forever unless the issuer calls the stock back. So you have no protection from rising interest rates. In 2007, we saw interest rates start to spike up, and we also saw credit risk start to increase, and perpetual preferred shares did quite poorly because interest rates went higher, and as long-term bond yields goes higher, it becomes more competitive with something like a perpetual preferred share, and they performed very poorly. But as the crisis onset, banks still needed to raise capital. They didn't want to sell any more common equity than they had to, so they created the rate reset preferred share, and this is a preferred share that is a dividend that is set for the first 5 years. It's still a perpetual security, but after that, your dividend is set at either the five-year Canada yield or the three-month T-bill yield plus a fixed spread that is fixed at the time of issuance. And this fixed spread has been anywhere from around 1% to 4%, depending on the level of interest rates at the time and the quality of the issuer. So rate reset preferred shares have been the predominant type of issuance since 2007, 2008, and that's what's mostly out there right now.
Same with the theme of preferred shares, the Globe and Mail ran an article over the course of the last, I think it was a week or two, that they mentioned that preferred shares were cutting their dividends. Is this true? Can you comment on this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that statement is, I think it's a fairly loaded headline. I read the article as well. And the way these rate reset preferred shares work is they're designed to give you a fixed return on top of the prevailing interest rates. And the overwhelming fear for the last 5 years has been a rising interest rate. So people have bought rate reset preferred shares with the view that if interest rates are higher, I'll get reset at a higher yield than I have today. Unfortunately, interest rates have fallen significantly, and some rate reset preferred shares are coming up for reset this year, and they are being reset at dividends that are lower than they were first issued. But the new issue market has been rather sticky. So rate reset preferred shares have usually been issued at a yield, rough numbers, about 4%. For a high-quality issuer. And even though Canada yields have gone from 3% to under 1%, people still want around 4% for a rate reset preferred share. So if a rate reset preferred share issued 5 years ago when Canada yields were 3%, it had what they call a 1% spread. So that's the fixed dividend you get on top of the government bond yield. If they're to get reset today, that dividend would be 2% on a $25 par. But again, people still want to earn 4%, so they're not going to pay par for that, and these are trading at deep discounts. So the dividends have been adjusted in line with what the prospectus says. So I guess you could say they've been cut, but it's not really the issuers going out and beating up on the investors. That's the contractual terms that were part of these. And unfortunately, interest rates have not done what anybody expected them to do when they were issued.
So last question on the preferred share market is, you know, what's an investor to do here? So, you know, let's say that they own some preferred shares and they're down a little bit and they're sitting there thinking to themselves, this isn't what I signed up for. What should they do? And what circumstances would make these preferred shares go back up?
We think for the most part, the damage has been done. It happened quite quickly. The real catalyst was the Bank of Canada cutting interest rates. So at the end of last year, the five-year Canada yield was about 1.3%. And at that point, the vast majority of the preferred shares out there, if you were to get reset, it would be at a reasonable dividend where you wouldn't see a lot of significant price volatility. That yield has since dropped. Today it's at about 0.95%. It went as low as about 0.6. And the market started pricing, of course, the ones that are getting reset soon, like they were getting reset these low interest rates, which is likely to happen. Unfortunately, since then, they basically repriced the whole market as if it was getting reset tomorrow. So even securities that don't come up for reset in 4 to 5 years are trading like they're going to get reset tomorrow. So the market is pricing in low rates forever. So our view is that that's overdone for the vast majority of these. And we think, you know, there's always issue specific things, so speak to your advisor and we could definitely chat about it. But for the most part, we think the time to sell has long passed. The drop came very quickly. There's no liquidity to speak of in the market, and they've adjusted very rapidly. And now, the way we look at them, this is a play on rising interest rates. So if interest rates go back to where they were at the beginning of the year, we think a lot of these will gain back some of their losses. Maybe not all, because some people are probably shell-shocked, but we think if interest rates go higher, most of these preferred shares should do rather well from these levels.
Within the fixed, you know, general question, within the fixed income market, what types of securities are readily available to the average investor that are going to benefit them in a rising interest rate environment? Are there any other asset classes or types of securities within that fixed income market that will do well in a rising rate environment?
So people will talk about things like high yield bonds and convertible bonds, and historically they've outperformed government fixed income in a rising rate environment, but they're still susceptible to it to some degree. The rate reset preferred shares are fairly unique in that this is something that should have a very direct correlation to a move higher in interest rates, particularly the ones coming up for reset in the next couple of years, because that's what people are most intently focused on. So for something that's readily available to investors that is not an institutional product that, you know, has a lot of derivatives involved and such, this is the most readily available product that provides people a hedge to higher interest rates. So if interest rates go back to where they were last year or higher, I think most of these will do quite well. The risk is, of course, that we stay here or go lower. We think the risks are tilted towards going higher, but we have to be cognizant of everything.
Terrific. Well, with that, I think that we'll close off the call, and thanks very much, Robin, for leading the call today and informing us of your thoughts on the equity and fixed income market and preferred shares as well. And we encourage your questions and comments from the clientele, so please do feel free to connect with us directly. Have a great day.